The Front Lounge is recorded on Shure microphones. Shure is an amazing company that's existed practically forever as far as microphones are concerned. They've been very good to us with the gear that we use both on stage and in the studio as well, and now for this podcast. So check out their microphones. You can drop them, you can throw them, you can bite them, you can smack your brother in the face with them, and they will survive and still give you a good sound. So Front Lounge, check it out, congos.com/podcast. Tell your friends, subscribe, and hope you enjoy this episode. It's a special episode.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Front Lounge with Congos. Today we're going to do a special episode, track by track, of our album Egomaniac. But before we do that, we want to apologize for missing last week. We were very busy in the studio, and we've got some breaking news before we get into the track by track of Egomaniac, and that is, some of you guys might have seen, we just announced that we'll be screening a festival cut of our docuseries Bus Call on April 15th at the Phoenix Film Festival. So those tickets are actually on sale. You guys can go to our website or go to the Phoenix Film Festival website and buy individual passes or festival passes to check out that docuseries. It's going to be limited. There's only one showing, so check that out before it sells out.
Yeah, it's going to be almost 90 minutes, the piece that we're going to show, and there'll be a little bit of time for Q&A. I think we will be there. Some of the crew will be there. And at the moment, it's looking like our series, we're still editing it, but this series is going to be 10 episodes, approximately 25 to 30 minutes each. And so this will be an abridged version of that, showing some of the different pieces of it. So it's kind of a little long-form teaser of what you're going to get in the actual series. So we're very excited about it. It'll be the first public viewing of this anywhere. And, you know, it's going to be, for us, quite a reveal, you know, show what we've been working on.
And also it'll be Dylan and Jesse's triumphant return to the Phoenix Film Festival, because you guys had a short film in there, right? In like 2004, five, something?
Three, yeah, I think
I was still in high school, yeah. So it was, and it might have been the inaugural. I'd have to check when Phoenix Film Festival first started. I think it might have been the first year they did it.
Yeah, and then also I scored a friend of ours' short film that played there at the Phoenix Film Festival. Yeah, so check that out. We'll put up links to the website, and if you're in Phoenix or nearby, come watch it. And this week, we're just going to get straight into a track by track of our third album, Egomaniac. So I guess why don't we start talking about why we called the album that, and anything else about the album in general.
We've done a fair amount of interviews. People ask us about the songs and the album, but the questions we get are never quite, it never quite pushes it in the direction where we might give an accurate, you know, view of where we came from on this album. And so we're going to do that right now. I think Egomaniac, the title, I think Danny said the word. We had most of the songs done.
I invented the word.
Yeah, I invented that word for this particular usage. We had a lot of the songs kind of done and other songs that didn't make the album, and we were trying to decide what to call it, and Danny said the word egomaniac, and it just clicked for some reason. It seemed like that was an appropriate word for the world at this given time, and we picked the songs that sort of fit that mold.
I heard a funny thing the other day. Someone tweeted or wrote that narcissists would be so stoked that he's become the poster child for narcissism.
The title for me really worked when we saw it with the image. We tried out a couple other images that seemed to work pretty well, but as soon as we saw that gorilla and the name Egomaniac, that's when it all clicked.
Yeah, it just seemed funny that an animal could so definitely seem to embody, you know, what we normally attribute to a human, the quality such as egomania, and the gorilla just seemed to have such self-confidence and overly self-confident swagger in his pose and look in his eyes and everything, and it seemed to just work.
So yeah, Dan, you found that picture somewhere, right?
I think you found it. But I just photoshopped it to not look like it was in a zoo.
Yeah, and then we obviously licensed it from the photographer. Where was it shot?
France, I think.
Zero in France, yeah.
Oh, so it's a French gorilla.
Yeah.
That makes sense now.
Also, the timing of it was, you know, we put this out well before the Harambee thing, but then the amount of people coming up to us asking us why we put Harambee on our album cover, we had to be like, fucking hell, it's not Harambee.
There's more than one gorilla.
Yeah.
And they were never concerned as to why we shot Harambee.
So first track on Egomaniac was Take It From Me, which obviously was the first single. And we just thought that that was an obvious choice for this because it so kind of perfectly captured the idea of what we were talking about for Egomaniac. Jesse wrote that one, so we'll let you tell us about that, yeah, Jesse.
I think I wrote a, you know, towards the end of the Lunatic cycle, we were still touring Lunatic and we started playing it on the road, figuring out how we wanted to perform it and the arrangement and everything. And, you know, it's one of those swagger songs where this trying to be a little bit of self-awareness in the lyrics. I think it was somewhat inspired by, you know, a few experiences where after a show or on tour or, you know, a big after party or something, you get drunk or you get out of it a little bit and you wake up the next day and you literally, it takes you a second to realize where you are and what, you know, what were the impulses that bolted you into this forgetfulness, basically, that you wake up and you're not quite sure who or where you are. And so there are layered meanings in the lyrics as far as these impulses in you that can be triggered and just run away from you and be completely out of your control, and then you have to deal with the fallout. And when it happens, when an impulse happens, it seems to take over and assume your identity and think, this is, nothing can stop me, I'm fucking in control right now. And then retrospectively, you find out that wasn't the case. So that's lyrically where it came from. The groove is just supposed to be a big fuck off, you know, rock / accordion weird swampy vibe, you know. And I feel like when we do it live, it's still better than the recording. I don't think we got the recording 100% right, but I still feel when we do it live, it works. It's kind of, it's greasy.
The video also for that, Danny did all of the video effects on that because we were sitting around waiting, thinking, you know, we couldn't do it because it's quite a technical task. But Danny came up to us one evening when we were all working in the studio and he showed us a little 5-second clip where he had taken Jesse singing the verse or something and made his head big. And we're like, oh, Danny can just do this for us. So then we locked him in a basement for about a month and he was going crazy just doing all of that. But it turned out, I think it's our best video, at least technically, for sure.
Well, didn't it? I mean, not per dollar.
Yeah. It also, yeah, the most expensive video for sure. But it also started because we took this photo. Marlo was around taking some press photos, and he took this photo of us on the couch, and we had these faces, and it didn't actually really work. It just looked like a weird, we were scrunched up on this tiny couch. But then when Danny decided to Photoshop it and make our heads big, all of a sudden that is kind of what kicked off the idea, I feel like, for the big head mode music video and all the rest. Mm.
And the picture that we have associated with that first single, Take It From Me, actually has enlarged heads, but we got so used to looking at all that imagery for this album cycle that it's hard for me to tell that they are enlarged. I'm used to seeing us with big heads like that.
And the second track is The World Would Run Better. That's one I wrote, Danny. I can't remember when I wrote this, actually. I think it went through a couple iterations. I do remember what inspired it. It was some long conversation, which at the time, you know, I loved, you know, because I like talking shit, and it was over coffee, and we pretty much solved the world's problems just in that conversation in total comfort. And then the next day or the next week, I thought about it, and then it kind of viscerally struck me as to how ridiculous that was to emotionally equate talking with actually solving something. So that's what the song is about. And then, as usual, we try to layer it so that if you just listen to it on surface, listening, you'll get some sort of pseudo inspirational thing. But then, if you delve in, you'll be depressed.
But also, definitely the lyric about Argentina being to move it closer to the house originally was Australia.
It was Australia, but Australia just wasn't... I think Jesse said...
It's not romantic.
Yeah, it's not... Yeah, we need something romantic. And then luckily we had been to Argentina and found it very romantic and like perfect. So we were just like, yeah, Argentina... It would be nice if Argentina was closer.
I think it's got this audacity to the lyric, you know, like... Yeah, let's just drink a cup of coffee and we'll fucking figure it out. Why don't people understand how to fix the world? Yeah, you know, like, I mean, it's clear to me. And
I can't remember. Was Ross on? I think it was Ross. He said something along those lines. You know, like anytime a conversation starts with, if everybody could just.
Although, if you think about it, we were going back with the old podcast guest Christian talking about the Dutch, and you think about the first coffee shops, they did kind of. Probably have a couple conversations over a cup of coffee that changed 500 years worth of history.
I really believe that there's a good book called The Devil's Cup, and coffee is one of the most important crops in human history, I think. And you know, now it's become this kind of novel hipstery thing where they design it and you know, it's just hard wooden benches and people choosing their outfit for the coffee shop, but it really was very important.
I think the best lyric for me, as far as I'm concerned, is I think the ocean has too many waves. There's got to be a way to make it behave. And I think language is important when you're dealing with subtle concepts like this, where you say, use a word such as behave, which you would normally associate with childish. Like, you know, the ocean is just something that can be pedantically instructed, you know. Yeah. And I think that contradiction in the language is kind of what hit it for me when I heard it. I thought, okay, I get it. You know, I'm on board with this song. Then getting the recording finished, I think it was a little bit of a struggle for a while, just because the demo was quite straightforward, sort of David Byrne pop almost. And we wanted to find a way, well, if the band were playing this, how would we play it on stage? So the introduction of the accordion and some of the guitar riffs, you know, it's still quite poppy, I think, in a good way, but we added a little bit of bandiness to it, I think, in the recording. And it's even a little bit harder when we do it live, a little more energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that image for this song, that's your hand, right? You made it look like a baby hand?
No, I just found a baby hand.
I thought you just really squashed your hand down to make it look like a baby hand.
No, I did move Argentina off the earth.
It's Trump's hand.
Yeah.
What's the third song? I can't fucking remember the track order.
No, I Want It Free, yeah.
Oh, I Want It Free.
This song was the hardest song on the album to finish, I think, or at least for me. I wrote it, and then Jesse wrote a chorus that we merged into it, and then Danny...
No, they were two completely separate songs. You had a song, and I had a song, and we were not satisfied really with either, and so we decided to kind of piece a couple songs together. You know, the main kind of basis of the rhythm and the verse and all that was yours, and then we just needed a hook, and it was a fucking nightmare trying to work on this song, in my opinion.
Yeah, and then Danny and Dylan spent hours and hours and hours going through the bridge section, you know, from Tokyo to Bogota. Danny had these lyrics lying around that worked for that. So, I don't know. I feel like this song almost was good. You know, I like it, and then every now and then I feel like it could have been done better. It just something went a little wrong in the process. I think the verses are really cool, the chorus is really cool, and the bridge is really cool, but somehow altogether it didn't quite stick. And I'm a bit sad about that, because I think at least the bridge was one of the best melodic bridges that I've written. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you can just repurpose it. I don't think it'd be a big deal.
Well, it's fun. Well, I take it's fun to play live for the most part, other than when I fuck up your lyrics. It's like this is the song behind Come With Me Now that I mess up the most, because the lyrics they're not nonsensical, but they're very difficult to grasp on first or 101st listen. And so when you're trying to sing it and then play at the same time, I think I fucked up the lyrics probably 40% of the time. But once the times that I did get it right, it's one of the most fun songs to play because of the groove, and it's a really cool riff to play, at least on bass and guitars.
Yeah,
and then Danny, for our live show, designed a lot of the live content for this, that is that old kind of 50s advertising thing that I thought's quite funny to see with this obviously sarcastic lyric and over the top, I want it free thing with, you know, this old fashioned advertising playing in the background.
Yeah, I mean, if you initially, I was like, yeah, critical of advertising, but then I actually turned, I miss that a bit. I miss that old advertising, basically honest advertising, compared to now advertising is so obscure and psychological. Like, I don't even know
it's
what
it's always got some sad kid, and,
right,
then, and
yeah,
then they're selling you a, you know, a heating fan.
Yeah.
Well, I
this
saw
Fiat will solve, well, I don't know, body I saw dysmorphia.
I saw a comment out there on YouTube or something, one of the social networks, on this song that was very angry at the lyric, saying like, no, that's not how the world works. You can't just want something for free and get it. That's fucking stupid. And it was just so ironic because he clearly just didn't understand the lyric. That's exactly what
there
it
is a hefty dose of cynicism in this album, at least lyrically. And I think it's a reflection of where we all were mentally at that time of making this record, because we came off Lunatic, this thing that we labored over for years and just couldn't get anybody to notice, and then a song, you know, Come With Me Now blows up, and then we chased this thing around the world for a couple of years, and now we've got to get back in the studio and, you know, follow it up. And we found out a lot how the business works on that Lunatic cycle. We learned a lot on how radio works. We learned a lot about the basically complete commerciality of the business and the quid pro quo-ness of getting anything done, you know, getting any kind of success. So that was swimming around our heads, and we were trying to think, you know, how do we bridge the music that we want to make with this commercial monster, you know, that everything seems to run on. And I think, I don't know, maybe 10, 20 years from now, we'll be able to look back and have a more objective view on what we did right and what we did wrong. But that was definitely feeding the cynicism in the lyrics.
Yeah, there's a quote that's often attributed to Hunter S. Thompson. I don't think he actually said it, but it's a funny quote either way. The music business is a cruel and shallow money trench, a long plastic hallway where thieves and pimps run free and good men die like dogs. There's also a negative side. So obviously it's a bit of an overstatement, because music business is better than most businesses, but it is kind of a funny thing that, like Jesse was saying, reflected a bit of our cynicism at the time.
Yeah, I always like when people use it's cutthroat. No, there's actual cutthroat businesses. That's you know, you don't need to use that figuratively in the world. There's real cutthroat business. The music business is not cutthroat.
Yeah, like television.
Well, except for maybe the 90s, like Death Row Records and stuff. Like, there was a lot of cutthroat there.
But. Yeah. The fourth song on the album is Underground, and Dylan wrote this one. So you want to give us some background?
Yeah, Underground. It was nothing. We don't have to dwell on this too long. Basically, it's I came across the story of D.B. Cooper, this guy who hijacked a plane in the 70s and he robbed a bank, hijacked a plane, and then parachuted out of the plane over the forests of the Northwest, and they never found him. And they found a little bit of the money that he stole, like buried in the forest, but to this day they've never found him, and it's still a mystery of where he is. And I just found it a really kind of fascinating story, and I was trying to imagine where he would be right now if he was still alive, or after that, you know, if he made it out of the plane. I was more fascinated with what he'd be doing now, you know, rather than like the actual origins of the story. So that's basically what it's about. And the artwork is actually the FBI sketch of D.B. Cooper. And also the song, I remember we were doing a mashup of Way Down in the Hole, the Tom Waits song, and Caravan. Or not Caravan, Freedom Jazz Dance. Mm-hmm. And there's a section in it where I came up with this kind of cool bass riff, and I thought for years that I wanted to write a song over that. So eventually just laid that down.
Are you sure you came up with it?
Yeah,
Danny
he came up with it.
100% I came up with it.
But I remember it because he came to us and he goes, I'm using that. I don't care what you guys say. And we're like, yeah, you fucking wrote it, so nobody's going
to
stop you.
Well, I tried to write a song. I tried to get you guys to write the song with me over that riff, but no one was really interested. So I just said, all right, well, I'll do this.
Again, I think the visuals for this on the live show are really excellent. Danny did those. I think they're on the lyric video also, right? A lot of them. So if you check out the lyric video for Underground, Danny did all that animation. It's really cool stuff.
There's a couple sort of musical references or homages in the recording. One of the podcasts, I think maybe the last one, we talked about that movie Real Genius and the soundtrack from it. It's got some of the best semi-unknown hits from the 80s, I think, on that soundtrack. And the one is called Falling by Comsat Angels. And then what was the other one?
Number one by Chaz Jankel.
So there's a couple sort of stylistic things in the synth part that we took from those records. You know, one of the few 80s references that you'll find in our music.
I like playing that one live because I play two chords in the same rhythm for the entire thing. And it's nice for me to do that because I feel like that's, I would like to be a drummer or a bass player occasionally in a band. I think it's harder in some respects being a drummer and bass player because you can't drop the ball like a keyboard player can. Like, I can mess up and no one really notices. If the drummer or bass player does, they notice it. But there's also a fun aspect to just being able to sit and be in a kind of a hypnotic groove-based playing, you know?
This is one of those songs that I think that's really important to be worked on by yourself in the initial stages, because I think, had other people been around, I remember doing the woos in it and doing kind of yodel sounds in my room, and then the bridge section trying to get as well, like the yodeling of the chorus over kind of a Native American type rhythm. And had other people been around, I think I would have been too kind of embarrassed to try out a bunch of these ideas, as you know, as well with the in the verses, the clickety clacks on the mouth. But then it comes together, you know, if you just have enough time to experiment.
Track five. Oh, autocorrect. I wrote this song in 2013, and it seemed very relevant at the time. And then the longer we took to put it out, I feel like lyrically it was kind of becoming less and less futuristic because it was coming true, you know? It's about this idea, some people call it the singularity, where machine and, you know, computers and humans kind of merge and become one organism. And just the way things are going technologically, I thought, what is everybody thinking about? Well, what are a lot of people thinking about? I'm thinking about our complete dependence on technology for existence. And what is the, where does that go? You know, what is the extreme of that? And I kind of pictured this world where you hadn't an automatic sort of software control over yourself and your organism that would correct for you. And as we know, autocorrect on text doesn't really work that well all the time. So what would happen if you no longer had to have any responsibility for your own consciousness and it was entirely controlled by a computer? And so, that's lyrically what it's about. And then I kind of had this, it's a little bit of a reference to Thunderstruck by AC/DC and Daft Punk. I wanted it to be a complete hodgepodge of influences, like futuristic and surf guitar and AC/DC riffs, and then heavy dance beats and
it kind of
African
reminds me
drums
of Mad Max. Like the scene where that guitar player is on the front of that truck. I don't know if you saw that movie. Did you see that new movie?
I haven't seen it, but I've seen that scene.
Yeah, it's a bit like this, just this every thing thrown in, you know.
Yeah, what's that? What's that? A steampunk, that sort of style. Yeah. So, you know, it went through so many iterations. I still kind of like listening to the demo sometimes better than the final record. It's one of those songs that you got to be in the mood for live. If it's dark and we've got the right lights, it's really fun. And then if you play it in a daytime festival and there's people eating hot dogs and sitting on the lawn and you're going, I want to get fucked up, it feels fucking lame. But
I think this is the song where you and Danny, or you and I forget who it was, sampled our piano. We did a bit of a prepared piano thing where we put pieces of paper weaved in the strings of the piano and then recorded each note and sampled it out so you could be able to play it on a electric keyboard or MIDI keyboard and get this really weird sound. I mean, obviously people have been doing what prepared piano, like, you know, altered piano for a long, long time, but you guys did that, and we've ended up using that sample quite a bit in various songs. So that's cool. Track six, Where I Belong.
Where I Belong.
Question mark?
Yeah. Those, I don't know why I forgot about this picture. This is just a picture I took of some, the single art for it, or not the single art, whatever the art for it is, these buffalo in South Africa, and I just painted them different colors, like they're fashionable buffalo. Where I belong. I can't remember when I started writing this. Usually I write a verse and a chorus, and then I got to finish a song a year later, you know? So then that's when the work begins. It's about, you know, I thought that the ideas of identity had been corrupted by everybody. I think identity is one of the most interesting and deep questions. And then this need to ironically box in identity prevents it from being discussed properly. So.
Well, also, this kind of superficial attachment to identity that you were kind of touching on, you know, this need to attach your identity to some sort of external manifestation, whether it's fashion or, you know, piercings or whatever, you know.
The UBU type thing. Yeah. You know, I feel like it interferes with a real question, which is perennial and has been around forever, which is, what are you and what constitutes you, and where did you even get this idea of you? And then, you know, what artificial ideas do you limit that definition with, and so on? And so it's like an endless question.
Yeah, the minute you identify yourself and label yourself as something, it shuts down a whole world of questions that could drive the rest of your life and try and discovery and that sort of thing.
My favorite lyric from it is, my shoes are a personality, a fractal of my geometry.
Mm-hmm.
And that sums it up for me kind of perfectly, as if this thing that you're wearing on your feet that someone else created is somehow a fractal of your internal and innate geometry or essence. And, you know, the sarcasm and the cynicism in that lyric, which Danny does very well in most of his songs, sums up this idea of the superficiality of superficial way of looking at identity.
Yeah. Okay. That reminded me of what inspired the song. It was, I think it was a documentary about Mandelbrot, this guy who worked at IBM, and he discovered fractal geometry, or he didn't discover it. It was around, you know, for a couple hundred years before him, but they hadn't really named it and named what it is. And it's fractal geometry is, you've probably heard of it and seen it, and you've probably seen the Mandelbrot series. It's when each smaller iteration represents like the larger iteration of what either a function could describe or something along those lines. And another like linguistic word for fractal is a synecdoche, and that's one of our favorite movies, is Synecdoche, New York. It's where Philip Seymour Hoffman plays this playwright, and he ends up designing this city and casting himself in the play and following himself around in the play. So it's fractal in nature, you know.
It's like pointing a camera at a television screen, you know,
right?
It's
yeah.
plugged into it, and you have this loop, endless.
I thought that was one of the best movies ever that I almost don't want to watch again because it was so difficult to watch. I don't mean like emotionally difficult. It's just you just had to pay such attention. It was so hugely complex that it's like it made my brain bloody hurt.
Initially, I was not into it because I was like, oh, this is pretentious, you know. And it redeemed itself, and it was all done intentionally. You know,
I just have such a vivid memory of watching that movie, where I would say almost 75% of the movie, I was intent on disliking it. I could not bring myself to like it. Mm-hmm. And then there was sort of a turning point somehow where it was almost revelatory. I was like, holy shit, this movie is amazing. And then from that point on, I just couldn't believe how good it was, you know?
Is that Kaufman, Charlie Kaufman that wrote it or not?
Yeah. Yeah, it's Kaufman. Yeah, and, so that's
my favorite kind of art where it really takes a left turn or surprises you in a way that you didn't think you could be surprised. Mm. And so, I mean, bringing it back to your song, this idea of a fragment of something being representing the whole structure, you know, where you can see the entire structure in a piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know that's quite a sort of deep mathematical philosophical idea, but I think what I could grasp from it off the bat was, you know, lines like, I think I need a new identity, a hotel with more amenities, you know, just placing these contradictory things next to each other in a lyric saying, I need my identity to be redefined. And I also need like a robe and slippers, you know, in my bedroom, I think it highlights the difference between approaching the subject of identity seriously and thinking about it in an internal way versus attaching it to some totally meaningless, superficial thing such as comfort, fashion, you know, some superficial expression of it.
Each one of those things, I feel like for me, was a almost specific reference to for myself. You know, the idea of being interested in fractals and this very interesting idea, and then also getting a sense of new identity from a pair of shoes, and then realizing that it was ridiculous. Or if we stayed at a 5-star hotel on tour one time or whatever, and they had a robe and that kind of thing, you know. And as you start to take up your environment as though it's you, and occasionally if you catch yourself, it destroys that little illusion. But it's just very funny. It's very funny to catch myself thinking that I'm sophisticated, or that, you know, or whatever, you know, something like that.
The chorus is kind of about that, where that element, either the observer in you or whatever, catches yourself and says, you know, I play along, but all my life I want, you know, that's the actual sincere part of the song, is the chorus saying, like, I play along with all this stuff, but deep down there's a part of me that goes, where do I belong, or like, what?
Yeah.
Who am I?
I'm trying to remember, because the next song is Birds Do It. We must have consciously thought about putting these two songs together conceptually, not just the way they sounded. Because if we didn't, it was very kind of coincidentally funny, because the picture, back to that picture, those four buffalo you took, and I remember the guide explaining them to us. They are basically the males that were kicked out of the herd as they get older by the dominant male.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget what they call them, but then it's something like mud boys, because they go hang out in the mud, because they, as they get blind in their old age, they become frightened of things easily and very, very aggressive. And these are the type, these are the buffalo that often are the ones that are, you know, attack people or kill mm-hmm. people. So seeing them in their little fashionable outfits that you put them in in that picture obviously then directly relates to Birds Do It, which is
right.
It's about sex.
Yeah.
And so yeah, did we ever think of that connection?
I think we chose the order based on the way that Where I Belong ends with this sort of, it goes back down to the acoustic guitar and just kind of drifts out a little bit, and then Birds Do It opens up with that funny high pitched synth sound, and it just sounded right together. So
yeah. Well, yeah, Birds Do It. It's kind of obvious what that one's about.
I mean, it's not necessarily obvious.
Well, yeah, I guess I do see some comments where people think it's about a fight in a relationship, or I've seen some funny ones on YouTube. But it used to be called Same Old Lie, this song.
Yeah.
And I think that is maybe more an appropriate title. That maybe conveys the message a little bit more than the Birds Do It. The Birds Do It obviously is the funny catching line, but
and as a reference to
That's a Cole Porter reference.
Yeah, Cole Porter reference.
Well, that song, the Cole Porter song, was so self-aware that it's funny.
Yeah,
I mean, you took a different lane self-awareness on the song.
Yeah, I think to relate it almost back to what we were talking about, identity is, it's funny to watch birds, literally, like in a National Geographic or Planet Earth type documentary, the absurd lengths that they go to in their mating rituals, and then look at human beings and think that we're much different. And that's kind of the imagery we have associated with this song, and the imagery I thought about when I was writing this is just this elaborate song and dance, and even down to literally the fact that I wrote this song is all often just, or at least in part, a weird little mating ritual. Even if it's not explicitly that, mm-hmm. it basically is. It's become so abstractified and so complicated in human behavior. But really, if you sit down and analyze most of what artists particularly are doing, mm-hmm. it generally boils down to that same thing.
I think it's much broader than that, and you even touch on it in the lyric about, you know, build your wall. How's the bridge go? Write you a song and build your wall.
Start a war.
Yeah.
I can never remember my own lyrics.
I mean, it's acknowledging the presence of this force, this, you know, need to procreate that every being seems to have. And then humans are almost an anomaly in the sense that this energy and this need is directed in so many different ways other than just procreation. And right. It's one of the reasons that humans are so interesting and creative and more complex beings, apparently. But the misdirection of that energy, you know, can lead to all kinds of things. You know, if you think about, if you could just imagine people in very high places of power who have this sexual need like every other being on the planet, and they don't know where to put it, or there's very sort of distorted in the way that they put it, and it ends up leading to wars. It ends up leading to, you know, unbelievably ridiculous projects, or it could lead to something great. You know, it's a very powerful force.
Yeah, it's just when you see a bird doing it, and it's, you're talking about hundreds of millions of years of evolution to get to this point where some of the things that they do are absolutely insane. Have you seen that fish that designs, talking about fractals, it designs basically fractal patterns in the sand to attract a mate. Mm-hmm. And it basically just asks the question then, where does art, when did that begin, this level of abstraction? Obviously it's a spectrum, but it's, you know, art, it's clearly art. That fish is creating art as a way of showing that it is right for sexual selection.
Right.
So it's just, I find that fascinating.
You're talking about aesthetics, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, the aesthetics is funny because I feel like a bird, it's not purely what the bird looks like. Part of its aesthetics and part of humans' aesthetics is their behavior. And behavior is like aesthetics over time. So it's selecting for aesthetics to continue for some reason. We know the Dawkins would say it's a gene that wants to propagate itself, but I don't even know how you get that idea.
When you see it in certain animals, obviously it's about pure physical strength. Like the dominant bull gets to mate because he beats up all the other bulls. Mm-hmm. And then in birds, it's not necessarily that way. And then obviously as you go through up to the scale of human behavior, it becomes so complicated that you can't actually, particularly now, you can't say exactly what.
No, because labor is so specific and divided and complicated and elaborate that you can't say what is a desirable trait and what, you know.
I think one sort of angle that I've heard on this discussion recently by evolutionary biologists, which I find quite interesting, is the fact one of the reasons why our society seems to be extremely distorted and messed up in many ways is that you have these impulses in us that have arisen out of evolution, you know, millions of years as beings have transformed into what are current human beings. It's taken millions of years to shape our behavior, to shape our needs, to shape how we interact with each other, how the sexes interact. And now our culture is so far beyond. It's changed so many times and it's changing so quickly, and the values of human beings, the way that human beings are valued in society, is changing almost on a daily basis. And now we have this evolution that's millions of years old that's got to somehow find a way to fit into that society.
Yeah. It's
crazy. It's,
I often wonder if somebody out there who's actually studied this shit can maybe tell us whether maybe there's, you know, now they've introduced epigenetics. And that was really from the 50s, but now it gained prominence in more recently, since the 90s and stuff like that. But it's a way of speeding up or justifying the sped up modification of the genome, that the environment can influence the genome and that can be passed on to the next generation and so on. Whereas in previous decades, they would have said that it's entirely random mutation and then natural selection, this very slow linear process. So I wonder if, despite having all of these millions of years of evolution leading to certain preconceived behaviors or ingrained behaviors, I wonder if it's can change much quicker than we realize.
Well, it also brings up the question that is everything to be explained through protein genetics or protein-based genetics? And, and obviously there are people that are saying, no, there are other mechanisms by which information is transferred from generation to generation.
I think they're applying the idea of, like what you were saying, you know, linear modifications of the gene and now epigenetics to different aspects possibly of our evolution, that it can't change everything. You know, your environment can't change everything as quickly as it as you would think, but it maybe can change some things, like very subtle aspects of someone's personality or or tendencies or whatever. But it's not going to, you know, rid you of the need for toenails or something like that.
Yeah,
you know,
that was that. But there was a, I can't remember the details of who it was, but there was a Darwin and Lamarck, and Lamarck, they were similar time, and Lamarck said that if an organ was not used, it would atrophy over the generations. And then some guy took these mice and started cutting off their tails, and he cut off 50 generations of a mice of mice's tail, and then the 51st generation still had a tail. And he said, no, you're wrong. And that wasn't really, I don't even think that was Lamarck's point. He was saying it had to be not used. You couldn't just traumatize something.
Right.
It had to be, and he was saying that it would atrophy throughout the generations. And I mean, I don't know, maybe they'll find more examples of that. There are currently examples of that. There's that, the Mexican cave fish is a good example of, and I don't know, how did we get into evolution again?
Well, we were talking about birds, dude. I guess one last word on the song itself and the recording. I thought this is a really fun song to play live, but it was also a fun song to record because everyone got to go a little crazy.
It's got a little bit of a drum solo.
So it's the actually the only song, I think, that I don't sing on. Almost every single song I'm either singing backups or lead or whatever. Oh, yeah. And then this is the song I get to push my mic out of the way and just fucking play drums, which I really miss sometimes. You know, I used to just play drums and not sing, and that was really fun. So I like pushing the mic out of the way and fucking thrashing for a second.
And then the next song, song number 8, is 2 in the Morning.
These we definitely did place next to each other on purpose.
Yeah, yeah. 2 in the Morning. Well, let's talk about the art first. I think that's, it's by this artist, Tato Caraveo in Phoenix. I think he's, I was going to say one of my favorite, but he's my favorite artist in Phoenix. He's just an amazing painter.
He is one of the managers or co-owners of this place called The Lost Leaf in Phoenix, where we used to play. We would play 4 hours sets, you know, or, you know, 4 45-minute sets with breaks. And that's where we kind of got our shit together as a band, learning to play our instruments. But anyway, it's this cool bar in downtown Phoenix. And this guy, Tato, we became friends with. And a lot of the art in The Lost Leaf was his at the time. And we were like, who the fuck is this artist? He's amazing. And it was him.
Yeah, he's got this really loose feel where every character has kind of got, you know, it's a bit Fear and Loathing looking. Everything's kind of warped and a bit liquid, you know.
It's also surrealistic influences in it, like what's his name, the guy that the time Spanish
Dali, so,
yeah, Salvador Dali.
I don't think personally I don't feel any of us are qualified to
talk about art
to talk about art in that way, but just viscerally, you know, the way he exaggerates the proportions and exaggerates certain facial characteristics to kind of to make an emotion or to make a state of mind kind of pop in the face, you know, is what I really like about it.
I don't even know if it's that, because I've seen his stuff lately where he's not exaggerating proportions, and he did this one that was just the silhouetted guys walking through a sunset, and it contained emotion, and I can't put my finger on why it has emotion, and he's just got something that he puts into the painting.
I think he's a really good example of seeing someone that has actually mastered a lot of skills, of technique, of art, and then is able to still be completely free in what he decides he wants to paint later. Because you see a couple of his pencil drawings or his just his realist stuff, and it's exceptionally good.
Yeah.
Well, I remember, because I was dealing with him, you know, with these pieces of art and trying to get them ready in time for the album release, and I started to get really nervous because on all three of the songs that he did the art for, you hadn't given us anything, like he hadn't given us any ideas. And I was like, hey Tato, anything we can see? And he's like, oh yeah, shit, sorry. Okay, I'll get it to you next week. And this went on for weeks and weeks. And finally I was like, hey, you know, so we kind of need to go to print really soon. And so I was starting to get worried, like we might need to start looking to other options. And then he goes, hey, what do you think about this? When I went and saw them, he showed these like basically completed paintings that captured the vibe and essence of these songs so perfectly. I was like, yep, okay, that's good, we're ready to go.
Yeah,
well, 2 in the Morning, I think maybe as it depends on what mood I'm in, but in a certain mood, it's probably my favorite song on the album. And I remember when you played the demo to me, I kind of just knew immediately, okay, this we should record this. You know, it's great, and one of the few more sincere songs on the album. But I just think the comments we get on it sometimes are funny. You know, I remember reading a comment on Twitter or YouTube or something that was like, "Fucking Congos going soft and selling out on us." It's like, literally, it's the least sellout-y song of the album. But you know, if you're insecure with your emotions, that's cool too.
This is the song where Jesse just walked around the studio with these goat bells.
No, that was Danny.
Greece. Oh, that's Danny walked around with him. Mm. Anyway, our mom had been in Greece visiting some good friends of ours, and she bought these goat bells.
Her best friend gave them to her as a birthday gift.
Okay, yeah. So the bells that they have hanging around goats' necks in Greece, so you can hear them. Mm. And they sound really cool. So Danny just was walking around the studio recording goat bells, and that's where a lot of that sound comes from in the intro and the outro.
Yeah, I think you guys know where I am. Yeah.
I think we have a video of Danny literally just strolling around the studio wearing goat bells.
Bah.
The drum part on this is maybe my favorite drum part on the album, because it kind of brought me back to our experimental jazz days where you could record the drums in a certain way where I was playing quiet enough that you could get an entirely different sound. When you play quietly, they record very differently. So
they become much more pitched.
Yeah. Mm. And we used to, when we played in jazz groups and combos and stuff at ASU, the cool thing to do was to have like chains and rattles and bells and broken cymbals and all this stuff, you know, to get different textures out of the sound. And it was a lot of fun. And so I got to pull out some of those tricks where I was playing, I had chains wrapped around my hands, I had weird pieces of percussion and doodads all over the drum set that to give it this texture.
I mean, on the snare drum, you had a chain that was long enough to reach the snare drum before you hit the snare drum, which I kind of like, because you can get pre-hits, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you hear the sort of
right
up to the strike of the drum.
This kind of reminds me of the new Fred Armisen stand-up on Netflix. I don't know if you've seen it. He's like, we've all played in one of these bands, right? Because he's doing stand-up just to drummers, an audience full of drummers. And then he proceeds to make fun of that era of jazz drummers that, you know, had like knitting needles and assorted kitchen gadgets on the drum set.
Yeah, I mean, Jim, well, for the epitome and the best version, I mean, he's amazing, is Jim Black.
Yeah.
That guy's, I mean, you can make fun of it, but he's undeniably fucking good.
I think what it is that Jim Black did it, and then
everyone
tried to copy him, and it was not the same thing.
Yeah.
Look at me.
At me.
Number 9.
I think this was the last song to be included on the album, because I'd been working on it and it went through various iterations. And I think we had 12 songs and we're like, oh, cool, we got an album. And then I thought, well, you know, just for the fuck of it, let's throw this one on there, because the lyrics were so tailored almost to the concept of egomania. And so there's actually another recording of this song that maybe we should put out for fun. It had a different approach on the rhythm and the drum part. It's the same recording, but the drums and the rhythm are different. I don't know what to say about this. I think it was written towards the end, where we were really honing in on what we wanted to say about egomania, and I approached it from that perspective on the lyric. It's probably one of the most overlooked, at least talked about songs on Egomaniac, but for me, in the right mood, I still actually really like it. I like the modulation in the chorus and stuff like that.
If you listen to the chorus on headphones particularly, I think it's an amazingly produced thing there, because vocally and, I mean, actually every part of it is very dense and complex and should be an absolute mess, but if you listen on headphones, you actually hear how well placed and dealt with that all that noise. It's almost Stevie Wonder-ish, I thought, when I've listened to it. Not quite. I think the art for this, there's an interesting backstory. These I was going to call these gorillas. What are they called? Giraffes?
Mm-hmm.
We've got a bunch of footage of this that you'll probably see in the docu-series. When we were in South Africa in 2012, we were at a game farm at a, you know, a national park. and it flooded where we were staying. We had to actually be evacuated out of the park on military helicopters. And before we got evacuated, we made it to higher ground where this other lodge was, and it was just water everywhere, the craziest rain I've ever seen, and this giraffe off in the distance looking out from the lodge in this perfect foggy day.
Yeah,
Danny obviously photoshopped multiple of them in there.
There's one different, I mean, it's one different shot where there's one giraffe looking at you in the cover.
Yeah, I remember that day very well because, you know, we all got woken up at 5 a.m. saying, you got to get out of here. The lodge is literally going to flood. So we jumped in Land Rovers, and luckily the owners and the people who were running the lodge acted so quickly. And fuck, I think, you know, we would be screwed if they hadn't kind of saved us, basically. So we drove to higher ground, and like 10 minutes later, we're eating this amazing pasta that the owner made himself, you know, after just rescuing us.
Yeah.
And
yeah, he was covered in mud from trying to get, I mean, they lost 3 Land Rovers, not in the flood, but just trying to get away from the lodge. They got stuck, so badly stuck in the mud at that point that they couldn't get out. And these Land Rovers literally go over anything.
Mm. Yeah, these are family friends of ours that we knew from when we lived in South Africa. They're some of our best friends growing up, and we've stayed in touch to this day. And, you know, they have this amazing place that they took us to. So anyway, we ended up at higher ground and having sort of a surreal moment of holy shit, what just happened? And at the same time, we're now pretty comfortable being fed and sitting on a patio watching this rain. And then kind of out of nowhere, this giraffe just appeared. It's almost like it appeared. You didn't see it walk up or anything. You just saw this giraffe sticking out, and Danny captured it, and it became a very sort of powerful image, I think, for the piece of art.
That's one of the funny things about elephants also. And they say this when you go to on safari in South Africa, is that they're very, very hard to spot, elephants. Mm. And you think, how is that possible? They are fucking gigantic. And then you're driving along and there's an elephant in front of you.
Yeah.
They somehow just come out of nowhere. And they're
quiet too.
They're quiet. And also they, because of their gray color, they actually blend in better than even any other camouflaged animal does.
Yeah.
Anything more to say about the song or anything?
Not really. It's, you know, it's a mood song. You gotta be in the mood.
Number 10, I Don't Mind.
I Don't Mind If I Do. This is another one that Tato did the artwork for and really captured the vibe of the song. It's actually of the Lost Leaf, that bar that Johnny was talking about that we used to kind of hone our chops at, and we played these long 4-hour sets. And after we finished playing, we often would then just drink, you know. Sometimes if we didn't get paid, we'd get an open bar tab at the bar, and so we would drink and hang out and party. And it was a couple times a month that we did this, and I just remember having one or two of those experiences where you get drunk to the point where it's not over the top. It's a really wonderful feeling of almost like out of body, where all your preferences and your ideas about yourself and your ideas about what you like and dislike kind of just disappear, and it feels like you're floating through the room. Like, you know, someone bumps into you and you're not immediately offended or immediately upset by this person who wasn't aware that he just bumped into you or whatever. It just kind of rolls off your back. And so I started having this nice experience of dancing and hanging out in the club, and I got a strong sensation of feeling that nothing that I think I know or that I hear or see do I really and actually understand or know what I'm hearing or know what I know. So that's where the chorus came from, which was, you know, I know what I know, but I don't know what I know when I know it. And I see what I see, but I don't know what I see when I see it. And it was a detachment of like my logical reasoning to my experience with the other aspects of my being. You know, I just didn't actually understand what I thought I knew. So
clearly the logical reasoning was still functioning in the background, because you were able to recall it and then comment on it in a lyric. You know, that's the interesting thing about these experiences where you feel like your logical mind goes away, but it's clearly some background process is still running, recording it so that you can analyze it later.
Yeah, there's a funny thing about this song is that Mo always makes fun of me, by the way, I introduce it. And because, you know, I used to introduce the song as like, this is a song that's about getting close and dancing and getting sweaty with the person next to you. And it was just an easy way to like launch into the song because, you know, I already had the, we were transitioning very quickly into the song. I was like, I'm not going to try to explain the meaning of this song in the next 5 seconds. So then Mo started making fun of me about how I do it. And he's like, when you say it, he's like, you're like trying to act all sexy when you say it. He's like, and we've got footage of him saying that. I think we might have to use that in the docuseries. But it really, I wasn't even offended because I knew it was true. After that moment, I started changing the way I introduced it because, you know, it kind of just came to the forefront of my mind. I'm like, yeah, that's lame. I probably shouldn't do that.
So if you look at the artwork for this song, you'll see a guy in the back in the bar with blue light sort of shining on him. And I believe that is a little self-portrait that Tato, he put himself into the picture because he, you know, he works the bar a lot at the Lost Leaf, and he's pretty much, he's like a fixture in Phoenix. In downtown Phoenix, if you hang out there, you know Tato and you love Tato. And so I think it's kind of cool that he put himself into the painting.
Track 11, this is Hey You, Yeah You.
Hey You, Yeah You. Also another one that Tato did the artwork for. Very cool kind of bar scene. Egomaniac, you know, we spent so long on the road. It was it was Lunatic that we started on, and then we spent another cycle on the road. It felt like we were on the road for like 2 or 3 years, so we spent a lot of time in bars. And so a few of these songs are kind of about that, and the artwork depicts that. But yeah, this song originally I wrote not even intending it to be a conga song. I had kind of come up with a cool, what I thought of was kind of a hip hop pop groove, and writing kind of these fast lyrical verses on it with a soaring high chorus, the chorus is kind of so high that it took me quite a few attempts to get it right in the studio that we almost never play it live because it's putting it in between all the other songs in the high range. I just don't have like the strength to continue the song. But eventually, I think we just said if we try to put a bit of a congas feeling to it, that it might work for as a congas song. So we attempted it, and it ended up actually working for us. I thought maybe like someone like Justin Timberlake originally would record it, but in this iteration, it definitely wouldn't make sense. But it's about, you know, two people meeting at the wrong time, and, you know, not just, there's being a spark, but it's not being able to continue because it's just bad timing.
Yeah,
that's about it.
That, and then the artwork Tato actually, he put on the wall. There's another piece of art, and it's another artist from Phoenix. That's JB.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Anyway.
Number 12. Repeat after me.
Repeat after me.
Repeat after me.
This song, I wrote in my room, in my bedroom. And it was almost by accident that certain things occurred on this, where I was messing around with some loops and snipping out sections here and there, and snipped out half a bar or a quarter of a bar at one point. And I found this interesting 7/4 groove that worked for the guitar part. So I had this guitar riff that I chopped into a 7/4 riff. And then superimpose that over a 4/4 simple drum groove, you know, basically just a 4 on the floor sort of thing, and finding where those patterns lined up gave it a really interesting thing, but at the same time I thought quite accessible, because if you do a 7/4 on odd meter groove and you're too odd meter about it, it's very hard for anyone to feel a pulse and feel, you know, how they should move or react to it. So, but if you really listen to it, it's quite complicated. And particularly, I don't know how you guys are playing it live, but for me, because the vocals are theoretically in 4/4 in terms of their phrasing, the guitar part's in 7/4, the bass is in 4/4, the drums are a little bit of both. So it's very confusing to play live. You have to almost ignore what everyone else is doing and just do your own thing on this song.
It's, yeah, Well, if it wasn't if it was purely rhythmic, if it wasn't associated with melody, what I was playing, I'd have to think about it more. But because you add the melody, it kind of dictates the for you a bit. It makes it easier.
Yeah, and I guess lyrically, it's about the idea of ritual and the meaning of ritual, and you know, the idea that perhaps it's not about the specifics of any given ritual. It's about your state of mind and your presence when you perform the ritual in order for that ritual to have any significance or meaning. And I came across this old Egyptian art that I think this is in the British Museum of Art. Mm. And then I was messing around on Danny's tablets. So I spent like 4 days coloring each and every one of those little raw birds and everything in. And obviously the Egyptians had these types of rituals that were, you know, hundreds, thousands of years old and repeated. There was repetitious rituals that I thought put a great visual to the message of the song.
Well, I think the lyric addresses so many, it kind of covers it all basically in terms of the different religious rituals and spiritual rituals and you know, pagan rituals and everything. These things that kind of seem to reach us from ancient years that still seem to have significance for some reason. And you know, you have to ask, why do people do this? Why were these weird rituals existing, and why have they gone through so many iterations through different teachings and religions? And I think the most important line is, "If I could breathe," you know, that this intention that you can put behind your breath, you know, in a way is an answer to a lot of this weird stuff, is that if you could just simply pay attention to your breath in the correct way, that it would give you an elevated experience that maybe some of these rituals are attempting to achieve.
Yeah, I think a lot of people might misinterpret that lyric. I think they might think it says, "If I could breathe," as in, if I could just breathe, like you're having trouble breathing.
Yeah.
And that, you know, because the verse lyrics are in this very monotonous melody, they're a little bit hard to latch onto. And then all of a sudden, the chorus is very easy to hear. "If I could breathe, I'd be free." And I think a lot of people misinterpret that, like, "Oh, I'm, you know, I'm suffocating or I can't breathe." And it's actually about the intentional aspect of breathing, to put real intention or consciousness into the breath, and that would free you from whatever habit you might be in which rituals can be. They can either be consciously done or intentionally done, or they can be just reinforcing habit, and that is the opposite of what the chorus, I feel like, is trying to...
Yeah, I mean, the bridge describe. Opens with saying, "It's so hard to do what I've intended." And I think the chorus obviously is the answer to that, that this is the problem, is it's purely a question of intention. I think looking at the artwork, I remember now, this is a depiction, I believe, of the soul going to the afterlife and standing judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So...
pretty dark.
Pretty dark dudes, those Egyptians.
Yeah.
Track 13 is the final track on the album, and I think, like, This Time I Won't Forget, this was the perfect song to end this album with, emotionally and sonically and lyrically.
Yeah, so I wrote this one, and it started out sort of as an attempt to just see if I could write a sort of storytelling song. You know, I was listening to a lot of Paul Simon, and I thought, this guy tells stories so well, and he seems to kind of be able to put himself, or at least put something essential into a story that sounds like it may or may not be related to his life experience. So that was the sort of idea behind it. And then at this, you know, guitar part, sort of African style, folksy guitar part started to develop, and I just kind of went with it. And I think what it resulted in was a song with, for me at least, has a little bit of pathos and a feel to it, a sort of resignation, a sort of positive yet indifferent resignation, you know, to certain things in life, where you realize at a certain point, "Hey, I might want to redo this," or, you know, maybe you get old and you think, what didn't I do in my life that I wish I had, or what would I do differently? And the resignation to understanding that that is not how it works, that you don't get to redo necessarily, at least not in this lifetime. You don't get to redo that. You have to live with it and contemplate the pluses and minuses that you've achieved. That's kind of where I was feeling with this song. And then the artwork was another one. Actually, a friend of mine from school, high school in Phoenix, Arizona, they went to, a guy called Ryan Parker. He's one of those guys that we were friends growing up, and he was a great artist. And once in a while, he would just, you know, show you a little comic he had done or something. And you're like, holy shit, this is years of skill beyond his age. And so when we were looking for art for each song, I thought, well, let's, you know, see if Ryan's into it, and sent him the song. And we had a few little sort of concepts. I said, you know, I kind of want to show like maybe an old guy with a bit of a reflective look on his face, and maybe sort of a yin yang thing in it. It was very vague, the sort of guidelines that I gave him. And he came back with a sketch, which is not far off the final piece, and thought, holy shit, he nailed it. You know, he put all kinds of symbology in it and really brought something to it. And I think he captured somehow, you know, for me at least, when you look at this guy's face, he captured it. He captured the feel. He captured this idea of maybe some sadness, but also resignation and an acceptance. And maybe I'm projecting onto it, but for me, it works.
No, I agree.
Yeah, I'd never, you know, I forgot, because it's been quite a long time since I looked at the artwork, all the little Easter eggs he's kind of put in there. I never appreciated back then, because I feel like we were just so busy trying to finish the album. I was like, oh yeah, that's perfect. Looks good. They captured the right face, but then all the other detail of it is actually very cool.
Yeah, so, he's a very good Instagram handle. His name's Ryan Parker. He's an exceptional artist, but his handle is I Draw Good Art.
All right, well, that's the end of our Egomaniac track by track. Head to congas.com/podcast to follow along and see all the artwork. And we have a YouTube playlist with the whole album up there. And also to get tickets to the Phoenix Film Festival. If you're going to be in Phoenix or nearby, come to that on April 15th. And as always, spread the word about this.
Yeah, so we recorded Egomaniac however many years ago, and now we're talking about it in a retrospective way. Just a little mention, if you are in LA, we are doing a little show. It's a very limited ticket event at the Peppermint Club on April 5th. And we're going to be playing some new songs from the upcoming album, so that are still a little bit in their formative stages. So if you're in LA, come check it out. It's definitely going to sell out. So if you want to see us do some new stuff in a tiny venue, the Peppermint Club, April 5th. Otherwise, do the usual shit. Tell your friends about this podcast. Subscribe, give us ratings, make us feel good about ourselves. congas.com/podcast. Laters.